Yemeni army releases new footage of its recent drone attacks on targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Canada's indigenous communities experience, quote, shock and despair after more unmarked graves are found at two former residential schools for native children. U.S. President Joe Biden continues to threaten Russia with a powerful response and more economic sanctions, even after Moscow withdraws some of its troops from the Ukraine border. Welcome. Our top story, the Yemeni army releases footage showcasing its advanced drone technology and capabilities. The video includes footage of drones used in the Yemeni army's latest attacks against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and its ally, the UAE. Saudi-led coalition has in recent weeks intensified its attacks on Yemen, targeting civilian infrastructure, including telecom stations across the war-ravaged nation. The Yemeni army, in turn, has ramped up cross-border retaliatory strikes. Sana'a says it will continue the operations until the aggressors end the war and lift the blockade on Yemen. Let's cross over to Sana'a in Yemen, where time has just passed 5 in the morning, to be joined by Hussein Al-Bukhaiti. He's an activist and political commentator, to talk to us a little bit more about this. Hussein, it's good to have you with us, especially this early in the morning. First of all, give us your understanding and your reaction, and perhaps, you know, what's better than asking you the importance of releasing such footage for the public in basically in both nations to see that?
I think this release of footage is a clear proof that shows that the Saudi and United Arab Emirates claim that those drones are launched from populated area, or that they are launched from airport. So this footage shows that launching those drones is just simple. They just need three metal bars, and you can put them anywhere in rural area in Yemen, and then you can launch them very quick and very fast. There is no need for runway. And as well, we have seen that this footage was so clear that the Yemeni army has not like hide the mountains or the landscape, because if you see there is some programs, either Google Earth or Google Map, that when you see a landscape, you can from that picture of the landscape find the area that those drones were launched. And I think this is as well a clear proof that anyone can look out and find that those drones were actually launched from area across Yemen. And as well, it is proof when United Arab Emirates and Saudi always claim that they have targeted the so-called the launching site. I mean, it's just three bars. They have used as well rocks just to hold those bars and then put that drones on the top of it. So it exactly shows that it's so simple to launch these drones from any area in Yemen, and it will be so hard for Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates actually to stop those drones against them. And I think that releasing this footage, maybe in the coming hours or days, Yemeni army will conduct a massive attack against Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, because it has showed the international community that Yemeni launching the drones are not in need to hide those drones in civilians' area. They don't need to use actually the Yemen Sana'a airport, and what the Saudi actually is doing is still keeping bombing the airport, and as well as they did in the last 48 hours when they have targeted Yemen telecom company. So they have cut off international calls from Yemen to the outside, thinking that those drones or those this company is used to launch these drones. And I think that Yemeni army should step its attack, because if it doesn't do so, that Saudi Arabia will continue to target Yemen telecommunication station. And I believe that Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates want to cut Yemen off from the world.
Okay, Hussein, one thing that I'd like to ask you, and perhaps that could be anyone's question, is that when footage of such advancements are released, one army is trying to communicate to the other one that they have something that perhaps can change the course of the war, or, you know, at least, you know, to play as some kind of a deterrence vis-a-vis the future Saudi attacks. Would you see this is the case with this drone, and with the releasing of this drone? Basically, Hussein, tell me, what do you think will be the impact of such advancements in the hands of the Yemeni army will have on the future or on the fate of the future of this war?
I think this photo shows those type of drones and how simple that they are launched and how hard it will be for the Saudi coalition to stop them. This is clearly will actually change the course of the war, but it need only one fact, that Yemeni army continue its attack. And I believe, as an example, in the recent few weeks, Yemeni launched 3 attacks against Saudi Arabia, and we have been now for almost 2 weeks they haven't launched any attack. I think if they have continued on a daily basis or on a weekly basis attack against Arab Emirates, they will force them out of the war, because it's so hard for the defense missile like Patriot missiles to target those or to stop or those drones from reaching their target. This was clearly in Saudi Arabia when Yemen has conducted hundreds of drone attack against Saudi Arabia. And as well, I think that the Yemeni army should actually, if they want to stop this war, they should continue to target and to focus, as an example, on oil infrastructure, airport in United Arab Emirates, and as well in Saudi Arabia, oil refinery and oil field, like they did before, targeting Baqiq and Khurais oil field, cutting off 50% of the Saudi oil production. I think this is the only way that Yemenis can stop them. But as well, we have seen that Yemeni army, after any attack conducted against Saudi or United Arab Emirates, they always say, we are ready for peace. So those drones are not actually only used to defeat Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, but as well, in another solution, is to stop them from continue attacking Yemen and forming a blockade that has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians. So it's Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates' choice. Do they want Yemeni to destroy their oil infrastructure and as well their industry, especially in the United Arab Emirates, or will they accept peace? Because we're going to reach one point that no return from it, that Yemeni army will launch maybe hundreds of drones and ballistic missiles at once against Saudi Arabia, against United Arab Emirates, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, and all infrastructure in this area.
Okay, many, many thanks. That's Hussein Al-Bukhaiti, activist and political commentator, who joined us out of the Yemeni capital of Sana'a. Thank you very much for your time, Hussein. Canada's dark colonial past once again comes to light with the discovery of dozens of more unmarked graves of Native children. An Indigenous community in Saskatchewan province has found 54 graves at 2 former residential schools. The premier there has offered sympathy with the Kisikus First Nation, I believe, says they experienced the same shock and despair as other First Nations across Canada. The new discovery brings to more than 1,300 the number of nameless graves found in Canada since last year. The country's authorities forcibly separated Indigenous children from their families during the 19th and 20th century to assimilate them into Canadian society. They were taken to residential schools run by the Catholic Church, where many were subjected to physical and psychological abuse. The church and the Canadian government have both apologized for the abuses. Ottawa's police chief resigns amid criticism that he did not do enough to stop prolonged anti-vax protests that have paralyzed the Canadian capital. The resignation comes as hundreds of trucks still remain parked outside the Canadian Parliament and Prime Minister's office. He says his personnel lack resources to peacefully disperse the protesters, with his defenders voicing fears that the use of force could stoke violence. On Monday, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked emergency powers to end protests that have severely affected the country's economy. The demonstrations were started by Canadian truckers opposing an order demanding unvaccinated cross-border drivers to quarantine. The protests have turned into a rallying point for people opposing various policies of Trudeau's government. Russia announces a partial drawdown of its troops near the border with Ukraine in an apparent move to de-escalate the simmering tensions there. The U.S. president, however, is not satisfied with the announcement.
That would be good, but we have not yet verified that. We have not yet verified the Russian military units are returning to their home bases. Indeed, our analysts indicate that they remain very much in a threatening position. And the fact remains, right now, Russia has more than 150,000 troops encircling Ukraine and Belarus and along Ukraine's border. An invasion remains distinctly possible.
Biden says the West will respond to a possible Russian invasion of Ukraine with military and economic measures, including shutting down the Nord Stream 2 project for good. That's the vital pipeline that would transfer Russian gas to Germany once it becomes operational. The U.S. president says NATO doesn't have missiles in Ukraine, nor any plans to deploy missiles there. Meanwhile, the White House says Washington could impose sanctions on Moscow even if there is no invasion. The statement comes as a majority of Senate Republicans introduce a measure that would slap sanctions on Russia. Talks are also underway in the Senate for a separate bipartisan anti-Russia bill. Iran's top diplomat says a good agreement will be within reach if the Western parties to the 2015 deal take a realistic approach toward the Vienna talks. Earlier, we discussed that matter in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Now, Tehran has called on the Western parties to the 2015 deal to take a realistic approach toward the Vienna talks. Iran's foreign minister says in that case, a good deal will be within reach. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a tweet following a phone call with his British counterpart Elizabeth Truss. This as Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are engaged in intensive negotiations in Vienna to restore the agreement left in limbo following Washington's withdrawal in 2018. Iran's top security official has, however, warned that proven U.S. noncompliance is the most significant threat to any agreement. Ali Shamkhani says a verifiable removal of sanctions and guarantees, the two main demands set out by Tehran, are the integral part of a good agreement. Iran's also repeatedly dismissed any outside interference in the Vienna talks between the JCPOA signatories. Joining us now for the program is Mr. Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kitchener, Ontario, and Daniel Kovalik, professor of international human rights from University of Pittsburgh School of Law from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there in Pittsburgh with you, Professor Kovalik. Your initial thoughts on Tehran sticking to its guns when it comes to verifiable sanctions removal and getting guarantees, especially considering the toxic nature of the fracture in lawmakers when it comes to America, the deep political divisions. You very well know that Iran at this point feels like it cannot trust Democrats nor Republicans. And you tell me, if Iran did trust the U.S. side, what's to say we're not going to be back doing this in 2 years' time from now, Professor?
No, I think Iran has very legitimate concerns. I mean, first of all, Obama, who signed the nuclear deal with Iran, never fully complied with the agreement to lift sanctions. I remember being in Iran in 2017, and people complained to me, hey, we poured concrete into these nuclear enrichment facilities. Meanwhile, Obama never fully lifted sanctions, right? And then, of course, Trump just backed out of the deal, not even claiming that Iran was failing to live up to the deal. You know, you had intelligence agencies in the U.S. saying Iran was living up to the deal, and Trump pulled out of it. So, of course, Iran is right to have doubts about the U.S.'s bona fides, about the word of the United States. Iran would be foolish not to have doubts.
Thank you, Professor. And Robert, welcome to the program. Robert Fantina there from Kitchener, Ontario. Hope you're safe and doing well there, Robert. Your initial thoughts on the fact that Tehran doesn't feel like the onus should be put on it right now. It should rather be put on Washington to get itself right with respect to this accord.
That is absolutely correct. It just makes perfect sense. As the professor mentioned a moment ago, the government of Iran maintained its commitments throughout the existence of the JCPOA. This was verified to the U.S. Congress. United Nations was inspecting their nuclear facilities. It was all verified. It was exactly working as it was meant to, except, of course, for the sanctions that Obama did not lift. But there was no violation on the part of Iran. And then Donald Trump unilaterally, and simply because he said it was, quote, the worst deal ever, pulled out of the agreement. And the government of Iran maintained its commitments for a full year, even though it didn't have to for a minute after the U.S. violated the agreement. But in a show of good faith, it did so. Now, the United States has a very ugly history with Iran, from overthrowing their democratically elected government in 1953, installing the Shah of Iran, who was a brutal dictator, and then, of course, in the last several years, not supporting the cause of the revolution and issuing these brutal sanctions repeatedly in the last 40-some years. So the Iranian government has every reason to be suspicious of Washington. And it was just what, 4 years ago that the U.S. Violated a major internationally approved agreement with Iran. There is no guarantee that it won't do it again.
And Professor, you know, Joe Biden, he blasted Donald Trump for abandoning the deal back in May of 2018, even as Donald Trump's administration started imposing sanctions, so-called crippling sanctions on Tehran. He even lambasted those, saying that they're going to basically tie any future administration's hands, and that from the very beginning, they're not going to work. And to, even when he got in office, he said they failed to, you know, do anything to Tehran as far as regime change or getting the Iranians to their knees the way the Trump administration hoped to. But nevertheless, it took him 6 or 7 months in his own administration to table this thing. And then now it seems like they are still dragging their feet. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, it's a great question. As you say, Biden originally said, oh, that was terrible. Trump backed out of the deal. So all Biden would have to do is say we're back in the deal. Instead, Biden has tried to get a better deal for the United States. He's tried to renegotiate it. Why would the Iranians agree to something less than they signed in the first place? No one would do that. Iran is not going to negotiate against itself, but that is what Biden is expecting here. And why? Because I don't think the U.S. was ever serious about this deal. First of all, let's face it, both supreme leaders, successive supreme leaders of Iran have said, have issued fatwas saying it's against Islam to develop and maintain and use nuclear weapons. Iran has never wanted nuclear weapons. The deal never was really about nuclear weapons. The deal from the U.S. perspective was always to be able to control Iran, to contain Iran. And given that that was the goal, no one should be surprised that Biden is now balking at the original deal that his boss, Barack Obama, signed.
All right, gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us. Author Robert Fantina joining us from Kitchener, Ontario, and Professor Daniel Kobalik there. Thank you for joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Viewers, that's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Following decades of U.S. soft power aid interventions to exploit South Sudan's energy reserves, the public is trapped in humanitarian crisis. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by T.J. Coles, writer. This article is published under the heading, How U.S. Meddling Split Sudan, Creating an Oil Republic Drowning in Poverty and Conflict. Stay tuned for more. The West's interest in South Sudan is oil. Invoking the colonial era, white man's burden of the 19th century imperialist, the U.S. government-backed Voice of America recently justified foreign interference in South Sudan by pointing out that the country's 3.5 billion proven barrels of crude cannot be easily exported due to the lack of pipeline infrastructure and financial mismanagement. The embassy troika and its IMF programs insist that fiscal data, including on oil and non-oil revenues, should be published regularly and without delay. Today, the United States regime has lost control of the proxy it created, and South Sudan is descending into a humanitarian crisis. Alan Boswell, a South Sudan specialist at the International Crisis Group, has acknowledged U.S. efforts in South Sudan seemed like a final spasm of naive American nation building, which has all collapsed in epic fashion. So what role did the U.S. play in splitting Sudan and driving the country south into crisis? Washington's slow push for South Sudanese secession probably began in the 1980s, with so-called civil society projects designed to boost the rebel groups opposing the northern government. In 1987, the National Endowment for Democracy, NED, the U.S. government-sponsored regime change entity, began funding the Sudan Times, which uses NED funds to purchase supplies essential to its continued publication. USAID reports in 1998, at the urging of Congress, the White House changed policy to allow the United States to provide development assistance to opposition-held areas alongside humanitarian aid countryside. So-called aid money continued to pour into the South in an effort to consolidate the rebels and build a sense of Southern nationalism in the public psyche. In March 1999, National Endowment for Democracy, NED, President Carl Gershman said, NED grantees continue to play prominent roles in the human rights and democracy struggles in Liberia and Sudan, where NED has mounted significant programs. But South Sudan, flooded with U.S. arms and training, descended into civil war. Noting the importance of oil to the question, an equation, AFRICOM stated that South Sudan's government in Juba turned off the flow in early 2012, charging that the Sudanese are siphoning off hundreds of millions of dollars worth of oil. Also in 2012, U.S. President Obama's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton traveled to the world's youngest country, where she and President Kerr discussed security, oil, and economic opportunity. U.S. efforts to create an oil vassal state did not go according to the plan. The South Kordofan and Unity states remained in conflict, with the African Union trying to mediate. When a northern Sudanese government based in Khartoum attacking the states, the SPLA sent troops to occupy the oil fields. Citing SPLA attacks, the Sudanese armed forces annexed Kordofan. A year later, in December 2013, Kerr accused Vice President Machar of attempting a coup. This led to the South Sudan civil war, in which Machar formed the rival SPLM in opposition. The peace of 2015 was ruptured after SPLM in opposition splintered and stoked more internal fighting. In July 2015, the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, reported, "The Obama administration is blunt. The humanitarian disaster now underway is the result of unscrupulous political leaders who have exploited an ethnic conflict that they cannot control." But the CFR neglected to mention who empowered these corrupt leaders. Thank you. Meanwhile, the public suffers the consequences of neocolonial games. South Sudan's GDP is under $5 billion compared to Sudan's already small $35 billion. Extreme poverty is over 60% compared to 25% in Sudan. Malnutrition is 12% in Sudan and not even measured in South Sudan, though USAID suggests that it could be as high as 50%. Infant mortality in South Sudan is 62 deaths per 1,000 live births compared to 41 in Sudan. The Republic is suffering under internal power struggles and violence, including a border clash that left 24 dead on January 5, 2022. Many of these economic disparities and political problems existed while the South was part of Sudan. But after decades of U.S. regime meddling, there is little light at the end of the tunnel.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and our heartiest congratulations to you all on a blessed birthday anniversary of the gateway of the City of Knowledge, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Let us reflect on fresh food for thought as bequeathed to us by the only person who was born in God's symbolic house, the Holy Kaaba in Mecca. O people, beware of fondness of this world, because it is the head of every sin, the door to every misfortune, the companion of every sedition, and the caller of every disaster.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at the justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. Now Amir al-Mu'mineen has been handed an opportunity to become the ruler and the Khalifa of the Muslims. He accepted another condition, that he serves the Muslims and he only applies justice to everybody. And he should be treated as one of them, and whatever applies to them applies to him. And they should give obedience to him, not to him personally, but to the fact that he is trying to serve them. And he said, I will be the first to do what I ask you to do, and I will be the first to refrain from that which I ask you to refrain. On the contrary, the object of the institution of Khilafah is that justice should be administered. The ruler should mete out equal treatments to everybody and to everyone, and should regard the efforts of a person who propagates it, the divine religion, and the servants and serves the public, should prohibit hoarding, prevent oppression, and should not deviate from the truth in any circumstance. He should not abandon his program even though the wicked and cruel persons dislike his just conduct, and maybe after his life. It is also his duty to acquaint the people with the rules of justice and prevent their deviation from it. These are the things that need to apply when a person assumes office and assumes power. These are the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he himself applied before anyone else. No one before him applied it. No one after him did. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he wrote to one of his governors and he said, you are holding this office does not entitle you to accumulate wealth or take revenge from any person. Your only duty is that you should destroy falsehood and revive the truth. Simply put, Amir al-Mu'mineen is drawing the line to the governors, to those who are in power under his command, that this office holds nothing personal for you. All your personal interests, your desires, and wherever you feel like, it has to stay at home. This office is especially for the people, by the people, to serve the people, nothing else. Destroying falsehood or standing against falsehood means there should be no injustice in the power that you hold, in the office that you hold. And reviving the truth means you should apply everything that guarantees people a just, safe environment and a better living. So it does not in any way, shape or form entitles you to use it to accumulate wealth, which a lot of people do these days when they are in power, or to seek revenge on people because they cross them, because they have the power. This is something that should be eliminated from any office, from any position that has power over the people. No revenge whatsoever. and not to use your power to accumulate wealth at all. Let us take a short break, then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are still looking at the justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi as-salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi as-salam, in his eyes, that rulership and khilafah did not mean that the ruler should sit on the throne of dignity, strengthen his power, and make his position the means of enslaving the people. This is an absolute distorted meaning of rulership and khilafat that those before him did and those who are after him did as well. Well, they sit on the throne, they are dignified, they strengthen their power and enslave people. He said, generosity and munificence is a greater source of love and affection than consanguinity and kingship. There is no greater like meekness, nor virtue like knowledge. He is simply trying to state that power and rulership and taking position, it does not bring people or makes people to love you or have affection for you, but actually the opposite, being nice, being generous, being easygoing with people is what makes you lovable and makes you accepted amongst people. Arrogance is not the way to go. So being a leader, being a king, it doesn't mean that you're going to be loved by people or accepted by people, as we can see the case of those before him and those who were after him. That's never the case. What brings people together under the banner of a just ruler is how much love and compassion and generosity he has towards them. Now, we can also see this in our current moral world, where those rulers who are generous and kind to those who are around them, you see people love them, even if they don't give them their rights. They might give them just a portion of what they should be giving them, but yet you see people happy with them. Where if you look on the other side and you look at those who hoard everything and they take position and power and they become dictators, those are the most hated people around the world or across history in general. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, when he dealt with the Muslims, not based on the fact that he's going to sit on the throne, not based on the fact that he's going to take power and enslave people, but in fact the opposite. It wasn't his personal gain or aim to strengthen his own power and increase his own wealth. On the contrary, it was him trying to serve the people as much as he can in any possible way he can. That was the mission and the objective of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam throughout the 4 years and 6 months he led the Muslims. His main concern was Muslims, Muslims, and Muslims. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على
محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله.
In 2015, Iran struck a historic deal on its peaceful nuclear program with a group of world powers known as the P5+1, the United States of America, the United Kingdom, France, China, Russia, plus Germany. Under the deal, Tehran agreed to restrict its nuclear activities and cooperate with international inspectors in return for the lifting of economic sanctions. However, this striking achievement in international diplomacy didn't last long. In fact, the deal turned out to be ill-conceived from the very beginning. On October 18, 2015, Iran and the P5+1 formally adopted the nuclear deal. Iran began taking steps to limit its nuclear program. Washington issued waivers on nuclear-related sanctions to come into effect on implementation day. The EU also passed legislation to lift nuclear-related sanctions on the same day. In its first report after the conclusion of the deal, the IAEA verified in mid-January 2016 that Iran had met its nuclear-related commitments. But shortly after, the US raised concerns about Iran's ballistic missile test this time, and on January 17, 2016, the country's Treasury Department announced that new sanctions would be imposed on 11 individuals and entities involved with Iran's ballistic missile programs. Almost 2 months later, then US presidential candidate Donald Trump said,
"My number one priority is to dismantle the disastrous deal with Iran."
All along, the reports issued by the IAEA showed Iran was abiding by restrictions under the deal. On December 1, 2016, U.S. Congress passed a 10-year extension of the Iran Sanctions Act, ISA, which became law on December 15th. All this happened when Barack Obama was still in power. When Trump came to office as the next U.S. president, Washington adopted an even more aggressive tone. On March 23, 2017, Senator Bob Corker introduced a new Iran sanctions bill, the Countering Iran's Destabilizing Activities Act of 2017, in a bid to target Iran's ballistic missile program. Tehran objected that the bill contradicted the spirit of the JCPOA, yet practiced self-restraint. The IAEA released its second quarterly report in 2017 on Iran's implementation of the JCPOA, reporting that Iran was meeting the required obligations. On July 18, 2017, the Trump administration issued new non-nuclear sanctions on Iran. And a week later, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Countering Adversarial Nations Through Sanctions Act, which would impose new sanctions on Iran along with North Korea and Russia. All these subversive measures came to a climax on May 8, 2018, when Donald Trump said he was pulling the U.S. out of the JCPOA and signed a presidential memorandum to impose the highest level of economic sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In the wake of this controversial decision, the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani declared that his country would continue negotiations with the remaining states in the deal to try and continue the deal without Washington. The European sides restated their commitment to the deal and promised to work with all parties to make sure its terms are upheld. On May 21, 2018, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo presented the Trump administration's new strategy on Iran in a speech at the Heritage Foundation, promising to apply unprecedented financial pressure on, quote, the Iranian regime. On August 7, 2018, a number of sanctions reimposed by Trump came into full effect. They included, among others, restricting Iran's purchase of U.S. dollars, trade in gold, precious metals, aluminium, steel, coal, software, and transactions related to sovereign debt and the automotive sector. On May 8, 2019, Iran announced that it would no longer confine itself to stockpiles limitations on enriched uranium and heavy water reserves stated in the deal, and could restart construction on its unfinished heavy water reactor in Arak and resume higher-level enrichment in the future if the other parties to the agreement did not deliver on sanctions relief. In mid-June 2019, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe visited Tehran and delivered a message from Trump to the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Trump was not deserving to exchange messages with, arguing it was useless to negotiate with the U.S. after Trump threw away everything that had been agreed upon. On June 28, 2019, the JCPOA's Joint Commission met in Vienna to work on INSTEX transactions as a way to circumvent some of the U.S. sanctions. But INSTEX soon turned out to be a non-starter, as the Europeans were not serious in helping Iran counter U.S. unilateral sanctions, or as described by then-Iran Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, U.S. economic terrorism. In fact, with the so-called maximum pressure campaign orchestrated by the Trump administration against Iran, and at the same time, minimum cooperation on behalf of the European partners to preserve the deal in practice, the JCPOA remained moribund for the rest of Trump's term in the White House. On September 25, 2019, then-Iranian President Hassan Rouhani announced that Iran would not engage in negotiations while under sanctions. He pointed out that talks with the U.S. would only begin if all parties returned to compliance with the deal. Meanwhile, the assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian champion of fighting terrorism in the region, dashed all hopes for reviving the nuclear deal. On June 25, 2020, U.S. Secretary of State noted that Washington would continue to exert maximum pressure on Iran until the regime decides to start behaving like a normal country. Just days before Donald Trump left the White House, on January 5, 2021, the U.S. Treasury Office of Foreign Assets Control imposed a new round of sanctions on Iran's steel industry. The election of Joe Biden renewed hopes. On February 18, 2021, the U.S. sent a letter to the United Nations Security Council, formally rescinding former President Donald Trump's request that all sanctions lifted in accordance with the JCPOA be reimposed on Iran. On April 2, 2021, the Joint Commission of the JCPOA met for its first consultative session in Vienna. The meeting was followed by five other meetings with little, if any, meaningful progress. The sixth session finished in June. On June 19, 2021, Ebrahim Raisi won Iran's presidential election. He had already expressed his commitment to reviving the JCPOA. On November 29, 2021, the seventh round of talks to restore the JCPOA began in Vienna, 5 months after the sixth round concluded. Since then, Tehran has been seeking the removal of more than 1,500 Trump-era sanctions. The Biden administration, however, has shown no interest in lifting these sanctions. Tehran also insists that Washington must offer guarantees it would not again withdraw from the JCPOA, as Trump did in 2018. Meanwhile, dozens of Republican senators recently wrote to Biden saying any deal would need to be submitted to Congress for evaluation, with the possibility of Congress blocking implementation. Republican lawmakers have also made it clear they oppose lifting economic sanctions imposed on Iran. So far, Biden seems to have failed to engage in a constructive dialogue with both Tehran and the opposition to the deal at home. Either the JCPOA is revived in the near future, or the Biden administration is faced with a bad diplomatic failure.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar led condemnation of a reported Biden administration plan to permanently seize $7 billion of currently frozen Afghan assets and distribute half to relatives of 9/11 victims, advocates pointed to the worsening humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan and urged President Joe Biden to change course. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Ilhan Omar Blasts Unconscionable Biden Plan to Seize Afghan Assets. Stay tuned for more. As U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar recently led condemnation of a reported Biden administration plan to permanently seize $7 billion of currently frozen Afghan assets and distribute half to relatives of 9/11 victims, advocates pointed to the worsening humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan and urged President Joe Biden to change course. Noting that there wasn't a single Afghan among the 9/11 hijackers, and the U.S. gives billions of dollars to Saudi and Egyptian governments, despite their direct ties to the 9/11 terrorists, Omar tweeted that punishing millions of starving people is unconscionable. Omar said she agrees with Barry Amundson, a member of 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, who lost his brother in the Pentagon attack, who warned the proposed seizure would cause further harm to innocent Afghans. Omar tweeted, "That's exactly what will happen." Khaled Beydoun, an Egyptian-American scholar, tweeted, "This is theft, graft, amid famine, no less. News flash, zero of 9/11 terrorists were Afghan," he added. "This is absurd." The advocacy group Afghans for a Better Tomorrow said in a statement that the proposed redistribution of Afghan funds is short-sighted, cruel, and will worsen a catastrophe in progress affecting millions of Afghans, many of whom are on the verge of starvation. taking money which rightfully belongs to the Afghan people will not bring justice but ensure more misery and death in Afghanistan. The group, which is circulating a petition aimed at convincing the administration to immediately unfreeze some of the funds, asserted. Phyllis Rodriguez, whose husband died in 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center in New York City and who is also with Peaceful Tomorrows, was among those urging Biden to reject the proposed policy. She said, "President Biden has the opportunity to make amends right now. He can unfreeze the funds belonging to the Afghan people. They're not the Taliban's property, but of everyday folks like us. Let's see this as a humanitarian crisis that we can address immediately." Others noted the dire conditions the Afghan people are currently enduring. Masuda Sultan, an Afghan-American author and activist with Unfreeze Afghanistan, said that Afghans are experiencing a historic famine within a pandemic and their economy has been in a free fall worse than the Great Depression. She added, "One of the main drivers of the economic collapse is the freezing of their assets. If the funds are not returned and the famine is not averted, America will be blamed for one of the worst famines in history." Rodriguez said that, "It saddens me that there are 9/11 family members who can see discrepancies in our relative privilege to demand reparations instead of recognizing the dire need of Afghans." She continued, "They have suffered unjustly for the actions of a cadre of extremists, a tiny minority of the population. Major famine, disease, displacement, and destruction that the U.S. government and its allies created should be reversed through all means possible." Miriam Benjamin, co-founder of the women-led peace group Code Pink, said in a statement that taking funds that rightfully belong to some of the poorest people in the world who are now facing a catastrophic famine is a cruel move that will not bring justice to the 9/11 families. Referencing the U.S. occupation that Biden ended last year as the Taliban retook the country, Benjamin tweeted that taking billions of dollars away from starving Afghans would be a fitting end to 20 years of screwing the Afghan people. Palestine Declassified.
Hello and welcome to a new series of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm your host, Robert Carter. We all saw the glorious footage of Algerian and Tunisian players in the FIFA Arab Cup running down the pitch, carrying Palestinian flags. We saw the fans holding banners, proclaiming their love for the Palestinian cause and dedication to the long-occupied people. Today, we examine what lies behind this bond. What is the secret to this connection? Why, when so many other regimes in the region are clamoring to normalize with the Israeli regime, are Algerians and Tunisians remaining steadfast and loyal to the Palestinian cause? Could it be the shared shackles of settler colonialism? We'll find out. As always, we'll be joined in the studio by expert guests to discuss these issues and to get to the bottom of the recent normalization trends in the Arab world and what solidarity in the face of that actually looks like. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report that looks at why after over 100...